All right. Well, welcome, everybody. This is Why is James Comey So Wrong About Encryption? Of course, James Comey ended up getting fired from his position of the director of the FBI. He's still wrong. It's just not quite as important that he's wrong.
My
name's Kurt Opsahl. I am the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're a nonprofit civil liberties organization based out in San Francisco, and we try and fight for your digital rights online. So I was going to give a brief introduction of the topic, and then we'll go down and everyone will introduce themselves on this fine panel. You're very lucky to have such great panelists today. And then if people have questions, we can entertain questions from the audience, or we can just talk a little bit about some of the issues it raises. One of the important bits of history here, and we can go into this into more detail, is that we are in the middle of what you might call Crypto Wars Part 2, the Empire Striking Back. There was crypto wars of the 90s, where there was a real push by the government to ask for backdoors into encryption. They did not want for a world in which they did not have access to communications. Just to make that relatively short story, it didn't work. And they were unable to mandate backdoors or ban encryption. It came up in a number of forms. There were issues about whether you could export encryption, and there was a period of time in which software would have a domestic version and an international version, and the international version would have ridiculously weak crypto, so it was easy for security agencies to break it. This was not actually a real check. Anybody who was remotely competent could figure out how to get the domestic version overseas, but nevertheless, that was the rule for a while. There was a proposal to have a Clipper chip, which I think Matt will talk a little bit more about. But this was a chip that would have a key escrow. And in fact, if you like this bit of history, Matt has provided a Clipper phone for the charity auction here at Dragon Con, and so you can get a piece of crypto history if you participate in that auction. So for a while, it seemed that those crypto wars had been won, but then they came back in full force. And I would say that probably one of the big reasons for it coming back was that instead of encryption being a relatively rare thing, it became extremely commonplace. Apple iMessage by default was encrypting iMessage communications, and so there are millions of people who were sending end-to-end encrypted messages without even knowing that they were doing so. We had companies like WhatsApp, now part of Facebook, turned on encryption, and with that, a billion people were getting end-to-end encryption. And this raised a lot of alarms in government, and they went back to a familiar refrain, same language they had been using in the 90s, "We're going dark." That we can't see as much as we can see. This is a bit disingenuous. This is one of the reasons why Comey is so wrong, is that it's actually the golden age of surveillance. They have so many ways of surveilling people, looking at location information, looking at metadata, that it's fairly disingenuous to say that they're worse off as a result of some of these changes. But nevertheless, that came for some push, and where this really came into a lot of the public consciousness recently was when the government tried to require Apple to provide access to an iPhone that was the company phone of one of the San Bernardino attackers, one of the terrorists who attacked the county community center in San Bernardino. And it wasn't his personal phone, but it was a phone issued by the county to him, and he had left it in this car, and then they sat around with it for a while and then decided to use it as a case to establish that they can force Apple to give them access. And this was a bit of a watershed moment, because it wasn't that they were saying, you know, use the sort of the powers that you already have, but rather make new code, write a new version of the OS, put it on here, and have it so it disables some of the security features. And so it was quite a big ask. There was a case about it. Initially, they got an order saying Apple had to do it. Apple resisted. Some 70 or so amicus groups, including EFF and Access Now, which Amy is part of, put in amicus briefs.
We got ours in first.
And they're super speedy about it. And then at the eve of the hearing, I mean, literally the eve of the hearing, some people had already gone off by plane to go down to the hearing down in Southern California. I myself was on the way to the airport. And then they said, oops, never mind. We found a way in. And so the case was withdrawn. The legal issues were not decided because they had purchased a exploit that allowed them to get into the phone without Apple's assistance. But the issue remains live. There has been legislation. There have been big pushes here. Currently, nothing that's really has legs. But overseas, around the world, there's a lot of encryption legislation. So it's still a very hot and very live issue. So with that sort of brief background, let's go to our panelists.
Hey, I'm Ishan. I work with the Internet Governance Project at Georgia Tech. I'm also a grad student there. And I'm also part of a group called Electronics Frontiers Georgia, which tries to deal with security privacy issues at the local and state level. So I think that's one way. I'm just going to put a plug here. If you want to be engaged at the local level, please talk to me or Scott about talking about encryption and stuff like that at the Georgia level. And talking about today's panel today, not only has this been a thing which you've seen in the past, it's also a thing which you're going to see in the future. Just because encryption is so good today is and so prevalent, when we talk about IoT, it's not only going to be your laptop or your phone which is encrypted, it's going to be your car and your washing machine and your refrigerator and, you know, who knows what else. So these are going to be more means of collecting data on you, of surveilling you, and that is why this battle is so important, to ensure that as we enter this IoT age, that whatever communication channels we have, whatever technology we have, is secured.
My name is Amy Stepanovich. I am U.S. Policy Manager at Access Now. We do global human rights where it intersects with technology. So encryption really cuts to the heart of a lot of the work that we do, not only working on encryption policy, but also actively encouraging people to use it through our technology helpline that provides 24/7 assistance to activists and journalists and other users at risk all over the world. So we care a lot about encryption because in our line of work and in the line of work that we help people with, it actually is a matter of life or death whether or not people can protect their communications. So it is very important in our field. On the other side, we have launched a website called securetheinternet.org that's signed by organizations, experts, people at this table, all over the world, trying to speak with one voice to say encryption is important not only for the safety benefits that it provides, but for the economic benefits it provides, as well as for the fact that we are entering a much more technological world, as Ishan said, and we need a lot more encryption out there. We shouldn't be looking at undermining it. And not only that, but in the Apple case that Kurt referenced, you can't undermine it really for only one person or only one group of people, say for example foreigners, because that process of undermining that security impacts everybody in some way or another. So trying to get to the communications of the quote unquote bad guys, whoever that group of people may be to you, is actually going to make it easier for people to get to all of your communications, including people you might not want to have access to them. There's the old adage, you know, why do you care if you have nothing to hide, that I take great issue with, because I think I have at least never met somebody who didn't want to keep some information private. It's not necessarily bad information. It's not necessarily anything that you're doing wrong. It's that people shouldn't have access to all of your data, and encryption in a technological world is the first line of defense that you have to make sure you can protect your information communications, including bank records, online purchasing habits, medical records, etc. And so that's just a few of the perspectives that we bring to this. And now I'm very humbled to turn it over to Matt Blaze, who's basically a legend in this space.
So, yeah, you already said everything I wanted to say. But, so I'll say some new stuff. So I'm Matt Blaze. I'm a professor in the computer science department at the University of Pennsylvania. I've been doing cryptography and computer security since somewhere around 1990. And one of the things that I start with on this is the sort of inescapable observation that I am in the only area of computer science that's making negative progress. You know, I have friends who do computer graphics and computer architecture, and every year, you know, what their situation is like a million times better than last year. And you have, you know, beautiful advances in just about every area of computing that's happened, and we have Moore's Law that says, you know, things get every 18 months, your capability doubles, and people just take great advantage of that. The one area where things are going backwards in ways that everybody will agree on is security, right? Why is that? Well, the reason is that there is one fundamental problem in computing that we know we can't solve, which is software correctness, sort of to oversimplify it. We don't know how to build at scale software that doesn't have bugs. Bugs have been with us since the beginning of software. Things fail all the time. What that means is we don't know how to build large-scale systems that are all based on software and get more complex each year that all these other computer scientists make computers do more stuff better. That adds complexity that makes it much more likely that it's also going to have unintended behavior. And so we're making negative progress on in security as kind of the price we're paying for getting all this great stuff like, you know, web pages with dancing frogs on them. And so we're now to the point where we're basically in, you know, I hate to use the word cyber, a cybersecurity crisis, right? I mean, you know, we're now using stuff for incredibly serious life and death, the economy, our personal privacy, you know, all depend on incredibly complex computing systems that get breached, you know, literally so often it's not newsworthy when it happens. And what do we do about it? Well, there are two things we know work. They don't solve the problem completely, but these are the only two things that work. One is to make systems as simple and as small as possible. We don't know, we are apparently unwilling to do that, right? I mean, software systems are just getting bigger and harder. The other thing that works is encryption. Encryption works because what it does is basically limits the number of components of a system that you have to trust, that you have to say, no, this can't have a bug in it. With encryption, you don't get rid of the bugs, but you reduce the number of things where the bugs matter. And this is essentially the only technology that we have that counters this horrible crisis that we're in. And so anything we do that discourages encryption or weakens encryption or makes encryption more expensive or more difficult is essentially going to take away the only tool that we have to counter this increasingly bad crisis. So on that cheery note.
All right. So, if people have questions, do we have the box? All right. Well, while we're getting that started, why don't I actually we had teased this a little bit before, but Mike, could you tell us a little bit about the Clipper chip and how that was broken?
So, the first sort of salvo in Crypto War One, before we knew to number them, was in 1992. The federal government worried about encryption. They worried because suddenly consumer products were just starting to use encryption in software. And they were worried that this was going to make wiretaps obsolete. I worked at Bell Labs at the time, part of AT&T and the Bell system. And AT&T produced a product called the TSD 3600, because AT&T has amazingly imaginative names for things, which was basically an encrypted telephone. And it used DES encryption, which was sort of the state of the art at the time. And the government learned about this and completely freaked out. And they said, hey, AT&T, you got to take this phone off the market. These criminals are going to buy it, and it's going to make wiretaps obsolete. And AT&T said, okay. But the deal was that they would replace the data encryption standard chip, which everybody kind of trusted at the time, with a new NSA designed, National Security Agency designed, algorithm embedded in a chip called the Clipper chip. And the Clipper chip would have stronger encryption than the data encryption standard provided, but with a catch, which is that it would essentially include an encrypted copy of the session key that's used to encrypt your conversation when it sets up the call, encrypted with a key that would be held in escrow by the government. And you'd get slightly stronger encryption, but it could be wiretapped because this copy of the key would be stored in escrow. This was, it turns out, a controversial idea. And pretty much everybody in the encryption community was horrified by this because, first of all, it added complexity to the system. Secondly, you have to trust, even if you trust the government, to only want to take these keys out of escrow if there's a legitimate crime. You also have to trust them to build a system where nobody is going to be able to get unauthorized access to the keys. And we don't know how to build systems like that, particularly if there are literally hundreds of wiretaps a day. So this database is going to be used all the time. They released this revised version of the TSD, the TSD 3600E for escrow. I don't think anybody bought it except the federal government, which bought a warehouse full of them. That was kind of the quid pro quo for including the chip. I have one of those. I donated it to the charity auction. You should bid high on it, except I think the auction might have already happened. I discovered some flaws that would let you bypass the escrow feature and use it in ways that the government wouldn't be able to wiretap, and that kind of killed the whole idea because it made it expensive and bad. And we spent kind of the 1990s arguing about whether encryption should be available, and then in 2000 the government basically kind of gave up and said, you know what, encryption is important. And we declared victory for a while, and amazingly, after September 11th, the government really didn't make any strong attempt immediately after September 11th to stop encryption, even though the political environment was one where they probably could have, because I think there was a recognition that this is an important national security issue. Being able to secure all of these communications matters. And then we went crazy again, and here we are.
All right, so we got the box ready for questions. And please, like on Jeopardy, phrase it in the form of a question. And try and keep it, relatively short as the questions go.
So, in my opinion, the encryption on the software side is kind of the easy part. Software is cheap. What I worry about the most is my endpoint being secure, and hardware specifically. There's not a lot of open source hardware out there. So I have an encryption company, and I'm trying to do all my stuff securely. And I'm in the process of trying to figure out what kind of laptop I should be doing that on. What's your opinion on secure hardware?
All right. I think endpoint security is a very, very important thing. Because if you have end-to-end encryption that is unbreakable, then the main option that the government has left is to, or any attacker for that matter, is to surveil the endpoint. I don't have a particular recommendation about what endpoints to use that are more highly secure, But Amy, did you want to talk a little bit about network intrusion tools and some of the effects that strong crypto has on attacks on endpoints?
Sure. I wish I had a recommendation for you, but I will tell you that the FBI has moved a lot into this question of device or endpoint security, as well as endpoint backdoors. And I think their focus from a policy and legal perspective is increasingly on that perspective as well. On the other side, I think, is the issue that Kurt is bringing up, which is the ever-growing use by the U.S. and other governments of hacking as an investigative tool. Mm-hmm. And to tease the panel tomorrow that is called Crypto Wars Update, U.S., Europe, and Beyond, I will talk about this a little bit more, but essentially the FBI in the United States has interpreted its normal authorities to allow it to install what they deem to be what they call network investigative techniques, and is essentially malware, except the FBI thinks that when it installs malware, it's not malware, that somehow they get to wave their magical not malware wand. Mm-hmm. And make it not malware. They're allowed to, with a normal court order or warrant, whatever process they decide to go through, install that on specific computers. And the reason I don't say on target computers or on suspect computers is because now the most infamous case where this was used was where the FBI basically seized and took over a server that was serving child pornography and operated a child pornography website for a period of time. And I believe made it more efficient and effective and quicker at delivering the child pornography.
Yeah, that was awkward.
And in the process, everybody who visited that website had malware installed on their computer so that they could track them. People took issue with this not because they thought child pornography was a good thing or that people who visited child pornography websites should be in jail, because I think that was relatively accepted in the community, but because hacking into computers has a lot of consequences that were not considered when surveillance laws were written. And the last time the government decided that they had a new investigative technique that was more intrusive than former investigative techniques, they passed a new law. And that's where we got the Wiretapping Act. And that's why wiretapping has special steps and special standards that have to be met beyond normal searches. And so because there is not a law on government hacking that recommends it, a lot of people took issue with this. The government has used this in other circumstances, including a case involving Tor mail that I think showcases a lot of the problems better than the child pornography case, because just visiting a child pornography website is a crime. Visiting a website where people can send and receive messages is not a crime. And whilst people could be using that for shady things, a lot of people used it for very legitimate, non-shady interactions, and they were also having malware installed on their devices. So it's being used very broadly. We don't have a lot of information about it, and I think that endpoint compromise is going to be one of the ways that the FBI ends up solving the crypto wars without massively undermining encryption. But it will, I think, have broad impacts on security because we can't control malware, essentially, and there will be problems.
So let me just add a little to that. First of all, the title of this panel is "Why is James Comey so wrong?" One of the reasons is that it was kind of his job to be wrong about this. Every FBI director has kind of had the same position on this, which is to advocate for things that make the FBI's job as easy as possible. And if I were the head of the FBI, I would want one-stop shopping for wiretaps in the infrastructure. There's absolutely no question that that is much more convenient and cheap and cost-effective and so on than having to go to the endpoint or collect evidence in other ways. The problem is the FBI's job isn't crime prevention; it's crime solving, right? Society as a whole has other equities, as tech people, as policy people like to say. We want to reduce the overall rate of crime. We don't just want to solve crimes. But the FBI's job is to investigate existing things. So the question is not what makes the FBI's job as easy as possible, because that's what they're going to advocate for. But the question is, what can we do that lets the FBI do its job that also doesn't endanger us in other ways that go kind of outside the FBI's charter? And, you know, given our cybersecurity crisis, having, you know, restrictions on encryption or requirements for backdoors in endpoints, you know, will make the FBI's job easier, but it's going to result in an overall increase in crime and privacy violations and all sorts of things that, you know, we as a society have to avoid. So I think what we're going to see is the ultimate compromise is that the FBI is going to become, you know, much more capable of exploiting kind of existing vulnerabilities that endpoints have, because we don't know how to build endpoints that don't have them. And they're going to use them for targeted attacks against, against their investigative subjects. Now, the problem is we don't have laws that really cover this very well, and that, you know, a lot of there's uncertainty about what the legal limitations to this are, and we are really going to have to address that going forward.
I'm really looking forward to Matt Blaze's upcoming graphic novel series, A Cybersecurity Crisis on Infinite Earths.
That would be awesome. All right, do we have another audience question?
Hi there. I guess to broach briefly on your question, I think she'd asked about hardware. I think the only thing, and not to speak on any form of expertise because I'm not an expert at short computer science, if you want to buy hardware, you want to start with a laptop or device that has a trusted platform module because it can store and generate secure keys on the device, and your software can utilize that device to do so. So you want to start with investing in a machine that has that. It's a bit costly, but it'll be worth it. A trusted platform module, they come installed in service frequently, but you can find them in more expensive laptops for security purposes. Sorry to breach on that. My question was, you guys brought up end-to-end point encryption with messaging, such as iMessage, WhatsApp and such, and I wanted to pivot back to that because, you know, as you see the general populace taking up iMessage, I find that there are a lot of dangerous divisions in that, because if you're not using WhatsApp and let's say you're using just your average everyday Android device, how is the industry and how are we as researchers promoting the security of mobile-to-mobile communications such as like just general SMS messages and standard, you know, phone calls that go through this general cellular networks? How are we going to secure those? Because I find that we're going to end up with a class of people who are still using standard SMS messages on Android phones and such that we're going to be classing out of encryption, and it's just a general concern of mine.
I mean, I think we're actually transitioning away from that slowly. I think we have a very insecure phone system that Matt can probably speak on in much greater detail and much more interestingly than I can. That's a real problem. I think the growth of WhatsApp and Signal and iMessage actually shows that there is a market for secure messaging and phone calls that people will gravitate toward and people will adopt, especially when you make it easy. And I think one of the things encryption communications tools have lacked up until that point was ease of use and usability. And when you start implementing them in ways that people don't need to input a private key and a public key, and why the hell do you have two? Sorry, why do you have two keys, and what do these two keys do? And I don't understand. And oh my God, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Instead, we have these very easy platform tools with good options. I think that's going to transition a lot more people. Availability of the tools is going to be a thing, and frequency of use and variety of use. I would love to get to a point where I don't have to have six different messaging applications installed on my phone that I communicate with people on. But I'm glad that I have those six and that many of them are very secure and people are using them.
Yeah. So can I just add one thing to that, which is that, you know, you hinted at a real legit problem, which is a kind of security digital divide, right? Which, you know, so I have an iPhone running kind of latest software, and I'm tech savvy, and I have all sorts of apps that can do stuff. Too many of them, but, you know, at least I have them. If you're running, but, you know, in order to take advantage of that, I need a relatively expensive smartphone with a data plan. And, you know, the cheap burner phone that you buy at the 7-Eleven that a huge fraction of Americans, particularly Americans who sometimes are the targets of criminal investigations, You know, they're stuck using SMS and voice telephone calls on those phones, and those are those services are largely incompatible with the kind of secure end-to-end encrypted apps, and that is an issue that we're going to have to confront.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think as what Amy said is very true, as technology becomes more easy to use and becomes more prevalent, so my grandmother's in India and she uses WhatsApp calling to call me, and that is the only person I talk to with 100% encryption. And, you know, it's not something I want to hide from anybody, but I'm really happy about that my grandmother, who is 75 plus, is fully secure in our communications. And so I think that is where we eventually want to see society to lead to, that, you know, with VoIP and with WhatsApp and Signal and stuff like that, that, you know, if you can already use audio calls on Signal and WhatsApp to secure your phone calls. So I think eventually as we move more towards these applications, you'll see that concern go down.
And I want you all to remember this the next time you use your mother or grandmother as the technological dunce in your lives. I know you all do it. I'm watching you. They know more than you do, I'm guessing.
I just want to tie a couple of threads together there, was that one of the things I think that's been very successful about rolling out encryption and helping with this divide is that WhatsApp is often being used, not because people care about encryption, but because it is a free way of making calls, or at least their cheapest option for making calls, especially if they need to make international calls. And so you don't have to convince people that, you know, encryption is necessary or they have something to hide or anything like that. You're just like, hey, free calls. You want to call me from India? Here's this thing, and it's free. I mean, so you have to have a data plan and Wi-Fi and so on, so it's not free. But the other side, which you were alluding to, was by talking about the Android phones. This is a big problem. We were, you know, Matt was just talking about the burner you buy at 7-Eleven. This problem is even more so throughout the rest of the world, where a lot of the phones that you can buy are going to be several generations back phones. That are maybe, you know, out of encryption security updates, or maybe in the last year that they'll get security updates, and that it's quite possible that someone buying a new to them phone, they'll put WhatsApp on it, but the phone itself has several remote exploits that are known and haven't been patched, and their endpoint is terribly insecure. All right, shall we have another question?
Hi. So this entire Apple versus FBI saga happened under what I would consider a relatively civil rights-friendly administration. So what we and that came fairly dangerously close to setting a dangerous precedent and allowing the breaking of encryption. And what we've seen globally is that there are a large number of governments and politicians who are willing to kind of stick their head in the sand and say, I don't care what's possible, what's dangerous, we're going to mandate this. I mean, something to the effect of, I respect the laws of mathematics, but what matters here is the laws of
Australia. Math doesn't work in Australia, it turns out.
Yes, which as a mathematician really hurt me. But what do you see as kind of the end state of this? Do we have to fight this battle every 5 years when the pendulum swings? Is there ever, and what happens if it swings so far that eventually we do get one of these terrible laws passed that mandates backdoors? Is there a constitutional argument against repealing, or for repealing one of these laws? And what do you see as the end of that?
Well, one thing is that in the Apple case, we did bring up some constitutional arguments. The arguments that EFF raised were First Amendment arguments. This is so not saying that the Fourth Amendment prevents this search so much as that the First Amendment is protects your right to free speech. Code is speech, and that was established in Crypto Wars Round 1. And therefore, the government could not mandate that coders were, you know, unable to do strong end-to-end encryption, because that would be regulating their speech based on the content. So if such a law were to pass in the U.S., there would be several challenges, but that would at least be one of them. But on the other hand, there are lots of other countries who have already passed some laws, which I guess that's a topic for our panel tomorrow, so we should probably hold off on that for now.
I will
say, come back tomorrow to learn all about the crypto wars in the future and around the world.
I use this analogy in DC and it doesn't get a lot of play, but I bet it'll get play in this audience. Has anybody read The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin? Okay, read the book, first of all. Bad nerds. I actually compare the crypto wars to that book, because in the book it's like everything is normal and you have summer, spring, winter, fall, but every now and then the whole frickin' world goes boom and you get what they call a fifth season, and it's basically times when mass people die and everything's in turmoil and everything's a mess. And that's kind of the way encryption is, where it's always the threat of having a crypto war is there and you have to worry about it and you have to worry about it, but you can pretty much go about your life and then something happens, like Edward Snowden reveals a document that shows the NSA might have tampered with encryption standards, and boom, and everything is a mess for a little while. I don't know if we can stop that from occurring. I don't know if we'll ever get rid of these fifth crypto seasons, unfortunately, and I think this might be something, because there's no way to win. They can keep pushing for a law until they get it. It's hard to push for the anti-crypto law.
Yeah, let me just point out what worked in Crypto War One was, you know, there was some great work being done by the legal community, the civil liberties community, but we didn't actually really win until industry got on board and kind of said, look, this is really important to the, you know, upcoming, you know, dot-com era that we have availability of encryption. Please just stop. And, you know, I think that was, you know, we can all pat ourselves on the back, but, you know, it was once we got industry really behind this and the tech industry really started its having a voice in D.C., that was really helpful.
Yeah. And just going back to the pendulum comment, I think, yes, every 5 years we are going to have this battle, and I think not only is it probably going to be a U.S.-centric battle, I don't want to tread on the next panel, on the panel tomorrow, sorry, but I think it's going to be a battle everywhere because, you know, if another country decides that we don't need encryption and they build a backdoor, that means there's a backdoor everywhere. So, and, you know, a more popular analogy might be that the encryption winter is always coming.
Mm-hmm. All right, another question, please.
Yeah. This question is for Kurt. I'm an attorney as well, and I was just wondering, how is it that you found yourself in this particular field? Does your background, your undergrad background, involve technology, or how did you find yourself falling into this area?
My undergrad background was liberal arts, but I was always into computers. You know, I had a computer since I was a small child. My first computer was a Commodore PET. I don't know if anyone remembers that. All right, thank you. And so just enjoyed playing with computers, and then after becoming a lawyer, started to do some pro bono work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and then there was a job opening there and switched over and have been enjoying working there ever since.
Hey there, sorry guys. Sean, I just wanted to tell you briefly to this side, not to feel ashamed about your grandmother. My significant other only uses WhatsApp to get calls from his grandmother in Lebanon. So I wanted to pivot back to mobile security again. Matt, I'd like to direct this question at you since Amy pointed out your skill set. So I guess moving away from the less secure infrastructure that we currently have to IP-based communications in the mobile industry, how do you see industry responding to this change? Are they actively responding to this, or are they moving over for efficiency purposes? Are we actually gaining more security out of VoLTE and other technologies?
Mostly no, and part of the reason is that the phone system is heavily regulated, and you know, one of the very few sort of anti-crypto laws that have actually passed on the book is a law called the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act that essentially requires that there be a backdoor in phone switches, including cellular mobile telephone switches, that allow wiretaps to be executed. And any encryption provided by the network itself, this has to be able to bypass that and provide the clear text of communication that goes through. End-to-end encryption, they don't have to provide the keys, but encryption that the network itself provides, they have to be able to. And that's, you know, an existing law. Phone switches all comply with that. And so, you know, and it also applies to things like the ability to deliver text messages in real time and metadata in real time. You know, and the question of whether that covers things like location services, those are kind of open legal questions. But so I would say that while the mobile infrastructure is becoming more robust over time because we're relying on it more, what it isn't, it also has legally mandated built-in backdoors. And that, from a security point of view, is very concerning because we've actually seen these exploited by bad guys. You know, it's not just law enforcement that's able to use these with a warrant. We've seen cases where foreign intelligence services and parties unknown have been able to find ways to get in and exploit these backdoors.
I wanted to ask you, go back to the Comey Apple situation. So I followed it pretty closely. The San Bernardino phone was his work phone, and Apple got into this big battle. And then all of a sudden, Comey said they got some sort of, that it was dropped. I wondered if you have any inside knowledge of whether they just dropped it or did they get some sort of a tool to break into it?
They did.
I heard it was an Israeli company that provided it. Does that mean that all of our iPhones are at risk now?
So we know a couple of things. Right before the hearing, they got an exploit, and they purchased the exploit. And just for a bit of terminology, I'm going to differentiate between vulnerabilities and exploits. So the vulnerability, if you know about the vulnerability, you can make the exploit. If you know about the exploit, you may be able to figure out what the vulnerability was on it. But they got what was known as a black box exploit, so that they weren't supposed to look and figure out what the vulnerability was and just be able to use the particular exploit. And as I understand it, the particular exploit works on the 5C model and maybe some earlier models, but not on the 6 or later models. So I think it is a good bet that if you have a 5C or earlier, that you definitely, well, you should always do this, but keep your security up to date and hope that Apple figured out what that vulnerability was, but it was not told to them what the vulnerability was. Yeah. The model number in the Apple world and has been incremented since. And it's possible that Apple fixed the vulnerability in the operating system, but the government didn't tell Apple what the vulnerability was. In fact, claimed because they bought a black box exploit, they didn't know what the vulnerability was, and therefore they didn't have to go through the vulnerabilities equities process, which the government has said, you know, that's what we do. We find a vulnerability, we go through this equities process to see whether, on balance, it makes people more secure to disclose it or whether it's more important to use it for investigative purposes. But it turns out if you just buy the exploit and not the vulnerability, then there's no need to go through that process, and so they didn't tell Apple. But it is possible that Apple, through independent research, through sort of knowing that this exploit existed, was able to discover it and fix it for the 5C. But also there are hardware differences in the later models that would make it unlikely that a similar exploit would work past the 5C.
And let me just reiterate what Matt said earlier, is that the bugs will always exist. We can't build, I don't think, perfect hardware or perfect software. There will probably always be something that somebody can take advantage of in your phone. And that's why it's so important that the security teams at these companies are able to develop encryption freely and as strongly as they can. Because once they start having to develop, I think I'm stealing actually Matt's words from another panel here, but encryption that fails only sometimes, there are going to be even more problems that we have to contend with.
Yeah. One other thing I just wanted to add is there's an interesting way of at least approximating how difficult it is to get into an endpoint. which is what is the price for a vulnerability? And so, as I understand it, the price for a modern iOS vulnerability is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million. A price, there was recently someone was advertising that they'd pay $500,000 for exploits to WhatsApp and Signal. And then, you know, a exploit to like a older version of Android might not get you much money at all. And so you can sort of look at some of these prices and have some idea of how hard it is to find these vulnerabilities and create an exploit for them, but also that there is a market, and if someone's got the money, they can buy exploits.
Yeah, and you know, just because this particular exploit was for the 5C or earlier model doesn't mean that this is a battle which is over, because I think the ACLU mapped in 2014 number of requests law enforcement had made to Android and Apple about these sort of, and there were like there were 78 pending cases where Apple and Google had received requests to unlock a device either from local law enforcement or the FBI. So this isn't just over. This was one high profile case which went to court, but it's a everyday battle for, you know, encryption policy.
All right, thank you.
Oh,
is this on? Okay, cool. I hope this doesn't fall into the category of, like, let me Google that for you questions, but with respect to, like, the backdoor that you said exists in current phone switches, what does enforcement for that look like? Like, is it, like, the FCC reviews, like, new, like, hardware that comes out, or, like so what are the teeth like?
So there's a law called the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. There are two ways to comply with it. One is to have the FBI sign off on your design. The other is to comply with an existing standard called the J standard for historical reasons, which basically says you've got to have this interface, and it's got to have this capability, and it's got to have something called a call data channel and a call content channel, and the, you know, certain amount of capacity to send traffic back to law enforcement on a T1 line. And if you comply with that, then you have a safe harbor and your phone switch is legal and can be kind of sold to phone companies in the U.S. So that's the, almost all these switches just comply with the J standard. And that's sort of, so they've come out with a standard for doing this. Now the interesting thing is that standard is a standard for being able to deliver content, wiretap content. There's no standard, there's nothing in the standard at all for how that has to be actually secured against unauthorized use. Yeah.
Hello. This is probably a stupid question, but you only live once, so why not? Are the conspiracy theorists right when they say that the only way to keep the government from spying on your smartphone is if you cannot remove the battery, to put it into airplane mode and then turn it off?
The conspiracy theorists aren't paranoid enough. is the short answer.
I mean, if you are being targeted by a government intelligence agency, especially the U.S. NSA, they probably own every single device that you have if you are a target. If you are a normal person of no consequence, they probably don't. But they could. That capability is out there. and so I think it's a matter of distinction, but the technological capabilities of what they are able to do are quite vast.
And to add on to that, to try to, you know, have the balance between what the government's capabilities are and your privacy, it's going to be very hard to get to a point where you cannot be hacked by a well-determined, well-funded adversary. But you might get to a point where it's really expensive and they can only do those kinds of attacks to people they really care about. Like, and that would mean that for, you know, 99 point whatever percent of people, that they're not going to care that much. But if they really care about somebody, they're, if it's, you know, if your adversary is the NSA, it's Mossad, it's, you know, the Chinese and Russian intelligence services, they have capabilities that are pretty impressive. But here's the other thing, is that probably going after your phone and trying to get it through, you know, a remote exploit over the air, You know, it's far more efficient just to send you a link and hope that you click on it with phishing. Like, most of the people who get owned do it because they clicked on a phishing link and maybe saw a warning or two, and we're like, yeah, but where's my dancing pigs? And then there's malware installed on the phone. So, like, if the, like I was going to say, like, one of the very hard to do but very important security measures you can have is to try to be very aware of clicking on links and who are they coming from, and look for signs that they are suspicious and don't click upon those. Also, it's hard to do on your phone, but on your computer, not operate in admin mode, so that if somebody, if you did click on the wrong thing, there'll be permissions limited and things like that. Because almost all of the attacks that happen are through phishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to add to that, you know, encryption isn't your only tool to be secure. It's, you know, a toolkit, as they say, that phishing is one other way. And, you know, there are lots of, like, small things you can do. Look at your privacy settings on your phone. Look at a lot of local law enforcement have something called stingrays, which basically act as fake cell towers. And, you know, regardless of encryption or Wi-Fi or the internet, they know who you are and where you are. So if you feel that you're in a location like that, turn your phone off or be on airplane mode. So there are, like, small things you can do to be secure. But, yeah, if somebody wants really a well-funded and well-skilled adversary, it goes after you.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the overall, I mean, the perspective is really important here, right? I mean, you know, in some sense, it's really, really hard to protect yourself against a government agency targeting you. You know, I don't know how to do it. You know, I'm good at this stuff. I really have no idea how I would live my life in ways that would prevent that. But the game that I think I can win is forcing them to target me in order to be able to compromise my communication. And I think, you know, that may be ultimately the societal compromise that we make, which is, you know, we know that they are going to win, where they is any powerful organization, whether it's the U.S. government or Russia or the Chinese government or maybe even organized crime, you know, that wants to target an individual. You know, we can't defend against that. But what we can do is prevent sort of mass-scale global surveillance, one-stop shopping, that, you know, that allows somebody who's malicious at the click of a button to, you know, to get everybody. And, you know, let's make sure that in order, you know, in giving law enforcement what it needs to do its job, that we don't inadvertently also create that one-stop shopping.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a bad thing that, you know, if the federal government wants to go after somebody, that they can get it. It's the fact that in our society, we want checks and balances that, you know, if they are doing that, it's after a court order, which is reviewed, and not at their whim and fancy. So I think that's also important to the fact that to not make it a global thing, but if they want to do it, yes, they can, but this is how they have to do it.
All right, I think we have 4 minutes left, so maybe we have another question or two.
So I've been in IT a long time, and encryption is not just one thing. There's encryption of data at rest, encryption of data in transit, and a whole bunch of other aspects of it. Does it help or hinder, or what's the strategy in talking about encryption as one thing versus trying to drill down into the specific aspects of encryption?
Well, I think actually you raise a very, very, very useful point, because one of the things actually was happening with the iPhone is that the actual issue was data at rest, and yet that the conversation, a lot of the conversation that was coming about that in policy circles was also bringing in data in transit and doing, you know, iMessage and WhatsApp and all of that. And so sometimes it actually is very useful to separate out those issues.
Yeah, and, you know, let me just add one more point. You know, there's data in transit, data at rest, you know, communications versus stored data. But then there's a third category, which is metadata. And, you know, encryption is great at protecting data in transit and great at data at rest. It's not good at all for protecting, in general, the metadata about your communication, when you're communicating, who you're communicating with, and where you've been, and so on. And, you know, that's sort of outside the scope of what encryption can protect, and yet can be extremely revealing about your, you know, who you are, what you're doing, what your interests are, and things you'd consider private.
Yeah, an example. I mean, if you call the suicide prevention hotline from the Golden Gate Bridge at like 3 a.m, do they really need to know to listen to your call to have a good idea what you were talking about? Right, they have the location, the metadata often is enough to have the thrust of the conversation.
There's a great study by Stanford CIS called Meta something. If you look at metadata study by Stanford, it's really amazing. Mm-hmm. People volunteered to have their metadata examined by researchers, and they lay out 6 or 7 scenarios, including woman calls sister, talks for 2 hours, woman calls health clinic, women visits health clinic the next day, where you know exactly what that person was doing. And it's just like, that is the revealing nature. There's also the idea that metadata doesn't lie and content can. So if I'm writing an email to my sister, the government then has to parse through the truth of what I am communicating. The fact that I am writing an email to my sister is just factual, and so they don't have to do as much interpretation.
All right, last question.
In regards to, you know, staying on the note of exploitation done by the government for, you know, the reasons that they have, you know, for terrorist or whatever, what do you think about WannaCry and Eternal Blue?
WannaCry, yeah, WannaCry was very interesting because it was a, you know, turning a revealed exploit that had it been revealed against the wishes of the government and turning it into ransomware. It had terrible economic effects. I don't think the WannaCry authors ended up making a whole lot of money with their ransomware on the Bitcoin side of it. So it was not a particularly profitable enterprise, but it caused a lot of damage. And this was, I think, for a lot of people who have been worried about this, showing the issues with having vulnerabilities that are not being patched because they're useful for investigations. There's always that possibility they'll get out there.
What do you think?
Yeah, and let me point out, 2:30 on Monday, there's a panel on exactly that right here in this very room. So stay tuned.
And as a productive way to end the conversation, because I don't know if we'll ever get rid of ransomware, sorry, everybody in here should go home and back up their data. Like, always have a backup copy of your information and encrypt it.
Right.
Because of the topic of this panel, like, there's a lot that governments need to do, and there's a lot of policy conversation to have about this, but you guys can do a lot for yourselves, too.
Yeah, brush your teeth and floss also. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that brings this panel to a close. Also, a reminder that if you're interested in security at 4 o'clock in here, is that right? There'll be a session on how to be more secure. And then tomorrow here at 2:30, we'll have another discussion of encryption. So I encourage you to come to that. And with that, please give a round of applause for our wonderful panelists. Thank you, everybody.
Come tomorrow and learn why this entire conversation is moot because of what the UK has already done.